Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 179, The Science and Poetry of Sleep, Dreaming, and Death.
Okay, so hi everybody, how are you? This is me, whatever that is. And I'm in a good mood today because I read a nice article about myself and my beloved wife and our life's work. And I guess my ego got a little bit involved, so I'm feeling good. But I don't know which ego, that's the Bob Thurman ego, I guess. But you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, which like Indian Buddhism, especially in the first millennium of the Common Era for 1,000 years, the conscious knowledge about the ego, about the self, about the I, about the aham, which is Sanskrit for I, aham, is so subtle and profound. And I always laugh when Western critical religious scholars make a big thing about, oh, it's a biography or autobiography, and they're building their reputation, or they're doing this or doing that. And, you know, like they're a bunch of natives or something. They're acting, you know, what they think of as natives. Actually, indigenous people are also much more sophisticated than they know. But anyway, especially these people in this tradition, they're completely self-conscious about the process of self-construction, the process of identity construction, identity habits, identity cultivation, identity transformation, based on knowledge of identitylessness and visceral experience of identitylessness. And furthermore, cultures touched by this tradition, they are all, even the simple people, they are affected by this, and they have a flexibility and resilience of identity that is different from cultures which teach kind of rigid ego. And you should just be this because you're in this caste or this class or you're this gender or you're this whatever it is. It's just sad that the planet is still divided in this way, and that people don't understand this process. Modern, critical, sociological people don't understand it. Some people, some sort of bad guy types do, of course, understand it, in the sense that, for example, the philosopher of Putin, whose name is Dugin, Alexander Dugin, he does understand it, and he has a philosophy about that the devil is this flexibility of identity. So he's the old-fashioned Western thing that if you feel some inner flexibility and sensibility, it has to be Satan. It has to, which actually makes you feel better when you're more open in your core. When you're more open-hearted, we have these expressions, open-hearted, open-minded. You have an open identity. Well, that's beyond us. We don't have that expression, but that is the right expression, actually, if our psychology was really clear. It was deeper. Which it will be as we meet more with the Buddhist enlightenment, let's call it, or Buddhist psychology. That does make you feel better, but making you feel better is bad for these kind of violent, vicious people who are into domination. They are afflicted by what Wilhelm Reich called the emotional plague, where they're beaten when they're young, and they're, you know, enforced a kind of imprisoned physical structure, posture. He was brilliant about it, Wilhelm Reich. You know, he was Freud's student, but he took neurosis and repression and these things, and he connected and fitted them to the neuromuscular system of a human being, and that, so he connected neurosis to neuromuscular armoring in a very brilliant manner. And the emotional plague is where militarist cultures, through violence, which starts in the family with violence against the child, and in sexuality, actually, with violence intruding into sexuality, especially, you know, pushing the male to think that's the great thing. And by the males, who are the ones who are then supposed to be the soldiers and the cutthroats and the slaughterers, you know. And this makes them hardened, where they don't feel internal empathy and sensitivity, and therefore they don't feel their own inner well-being, and therefore they become sadistic and weird and manipulative, because frustrated and basically miserable, fantasizing that there's some well-being out somewhere in the form of status or money or dominance, power. And then they also become, they torture and they like to kill animals and things, because they like to watch them wriggle and they like to see sort of that's a life, lively, you know. Violence produces liveliness in the victim. And then this makes the person feel like better. And then his emotional plague thing is so brilliant. His little pamphlet that I'm writing was called The Emotional Plague and the Murder of Christ. It's a total classic. Of course, it has it's a pamphlet, and it has its kind of frustration of having dealt with the Russian Revolution, the destruction of the Weimar Republic in Germany, and then coming over here and dealing with McCarthyism and 50s, rigid America, we won the war and we're the owners of the planet, you know, sort of the rigid side of America, the Pentagon side of America. So then he wrote The Emotional Plague, The Murder of Christ is the title. And what he meant by that was, for him, Christ was a person who had conquered the emotional plague in his own body and mind. And therefore he had charisma in the real sense, charisma of person, and charisma being a kind of flowing field energy because of a great well-being feeling inside him, a blessed feeling inside him. People around him felt blessed. And so when he met someone with the emotional plague, on the other hand, who was afraid of his own inner melting feeling, his own inner softness, his own or her own inner gentleness and blissfulness and contentment, was afraid of that, then if they feel that coming up inside themselves in the field of a Christ-like figure or Christ himself, and then they want to shut down that person because they subliminally, instinctually sense that what is threatening their blocks, their most neuromuscular armoring, as he called it, the armor that they wear shutting off their inner sensations, you know, is being threatened by this person. So they want to kill that person, so they want to murder Christ, you know. And they, you know, and then males want to choke and strangle females and shut them down and imprison them, you know. Even though the melting of females is their one source of joy and pleasure in life, in that it can lead them to find their own inner melting, you know, when they cure themselves from the emotional plague. Just as Jesus undoubtedly had a nice warm relationship with Mary Magdalene that has been buried under the emotional plague attitudes of the different churches. So I just got off on that, but it wasn't my intention today. My intention today is to talk about sleep. And starting with an anecdote, one time when I was sort of just getting started here in Woodstock building this house, and I was hosting the great Tibetan doctor Yishi Dunden, who in his 90s still lives, and who was my teacher of Tibetan medicine, and who visited Menla when we were first given it, with his last trip to America. And he was so happy because he used to dream there would be Tibetan medicine sort of healing place in the West. And he urged me to plant lots of fruit trees. And We have fruit trees, but we haven't even pruned the old ones properly. It's very slow getting it all done. And then I want to build a temple to Medicine Buddha there too. But we have a temple to people in the sense that we have a wonderful spa there. Anyway, A gentleman from Parabola magazine, who the wonderful late William Siegel, a great person, disciple of Gurdjieff, living one of the few at that time who personally studied with Gurdjieff, who was a kind of great Buddhist in the sense of enlightenmentist teacher, although not a card-carrying Buddhist, because he was not into the denominationalism like I'm not, actually, even though I'm closest to a Buddha, closer formally to a Buddhist. I guess I'm a Buddhist. But I have my idea of what it is, rather than just belonging to something. It is being in the refuge of being aware of the presence of the force of enlightenment in the universe. The force, you know, like the Jedi. A positive force, though, not a war force. Anyway, he asked this question. I had been set up for Parabola, and he was wanted to interview the Dalai Lama's personal physician and great healer himself, Yeshe Dundan. So then he said, okay, what's the first question, Bill? And he says, could you tell me something about sleep? And I was like, what? You have this amazing healer, great person, also a great yogi himself, and scholar of philosophy, and you're asking about sleep? I was kind of like trying to, like, don't ask that, you know, but anyway, I translated it. But the doctor wasn't thrown in the slightest, and he went into this amazing discussion of sleep. And from talking about what sleep really is, I realized I didn't actually know what it was, even though I'd been doing it at that point maybe for almost 30 years. And everybody does it every day. You have to. And some people have a hard time doing it, which is very, very, very harmful to their health. I think I had a friend in France when I was younger who was a painter, very, very sort of neurotic, nervous person, but really sweet. Edilbert Vacheron, his name. He, I'm sure, passed away by now. But he almost died because he couldn't sleep. And I think in the 22nd day or the 17th day or the 27th day, I can't remember because I wasn't there. He told me only the story. But they were trying all methods to get him to sleep, giving him all kind of pills, injections, everything. He couldn't sleep until finally he did. And I forget what was the breakthrough. Maybe it was fine vintage of wine or something, a dessert wine or something, I don't know what it was. Something made him finally sleep and he survived. But they were worried he would die. He was in ICU with the disease, nervous disease of him being unable to sleep. And he said it was considered fatal, lethal, life-threatening. So let me talk a little about sleep. Sleep, there are three phases in the normal cycle of human life. Or any animal, actually, because they're all the same. They're all human. Every animal is an ex-human, from Buddhist point of view. Every human is an ex-animal. I mean, non-human animal. Humans are still an animal, but a non-human animal. And gods are animals, also. Anima is the Latin word for soul. So animal means one who has a mind or a soul. Soul being just a word for subtle mind, super subtle mind. So, but anyway, humans we're talking about, because I hope you're human. I don't know how to talk to animals, unfortunately, the non-human ones. But you sleep deeply, so you feel unconscious at that time, as far as your memory of the time. So you're never conscious of being unconscious, actually. You just always had a threshold of coming, going in or coming out. And then there's dreaming while sleeping, where you are conscious, although you don't know it was a dream while you're in it, unless you have developed the ability to lucid dream, or occasionally you fall into what is called a lucid dream, which just means that, wow, I'm having this experience, but I know that I'm dreaming without waking up. In other words, you kind of wake, your degree of wakefulness or mindfulness of yourself being in a dream, and yet you're still in a dream, you're not awake. So, you know, your brain has reproduced in the environment that it has also reproduced, which seems like an external environment, it has reproduced a set of senses. Although normally in a dream, we rarely ever think of what they are. Like, we don't look at ourselves in a mirror in a dream. and see our face. So later, when we remember the dream, we assume it was the same face we were looking out of, or the same ears we were hearing into, or hearing out of. If we smell or taste or touch, which is quite, I think, rare in a dream, but it happens. So we imagine we have that body, but we're very much not aware of that, I think. And then there's being awake. Although even then in awake, you can, you know, this is just this useful heuristic, because sometimes when you daydream when you're awake, you're sort of unaware of what's around you, and your mind is going off on a trip into a daydream. And someone will have to shake you out of it sometimes, right? So in a way, you can kind of dream while waking. And then from a Buddhist point of view, actually, when you're waking and just going along on a kind of mental inner narrative, let's say, or just swept away on sense stimuli, being just completely engaged in sense experience, then without a sort of sense of self-awareness, then you can wake and become lucidly awake, where you're also self-aware at the same time. That, again, takes a little effort. I think the mindfulness meditation craze that probably many of you who might be listening to this podcast might have practiced or might or certainly are aware of, it really is cultivating that ability to be self-aware at the same time as aware of what's around you and also what's within you. So that mindfulness would be translated as mindfulness, because in a way we're always mindful when we're awake, but it's really reflexivity. It's really self-remembering. It was a great expression of Uspensky's. It's another disciple of Gurdjieff, the philosophical one. It's kind of a self-remembering. And the literal Sanskrit word that everyone translates into, Sanskrit or Pali word, as mindfulness, sati or smriti, means remembering. That's all it means. It's the same word for remembering. So it's like remembering while you're actually present is like remembering yourself as a being in the present. This then cultivates that different, more deeper sense of wakeful or lucid awakeness. By the way, I'm sorry, I'm just complicating things, because that's interesting, actually. And you should learn that. You should learn that you can be mindful while you're running around and doing things. And at first, when you do, you will feel maybe self-conscious, and you will be a little slow in your dealings, and you'll feel maybe this is very, you know, you could become paralyzed. What should I say now? I'm thinking, and aware of what I'm thinking before I say, or not thinking before. You know, you get into a thing like that. You can get into a kind of recursive loops, but actually, eventually, you can be lucidly awake, much more aware of everything that you do, and being aware in a more deep way, and aware that you're aware at the same time, at least in your subjective sense of yourself, and this develops into a more enlightened way of being. And more vivid and more vital and vitalizing. So do think about it. But anyway, that's complicating matters, I apologize. But the point is that sleeping, dreaming, and waking, these are three things. And traditional yogic, either Buddhist or Hindu, or Vaishnavite or Shaivite, you know, Hindu is too broad, really. There are different religions, really, Shaivism and Vaishnavism, Shaktism, goddessism. India is such a huge basket of spiritualities, you know. So they all have this kind of awareness, sleeping, dreaming, and waking. And these connect in the larger life cycle, which is common sense reality for all these people, with dying or death, with between state, the after death state, the between death and rebirth state, and then birth, which is goes from actual conception to death again. Not just from birth outside the womb, but birth in the womb, the entry of the soul into the seeds of the parents, which happens with the conception in the Buddhist view. And Buddhist scientific view, not just a wishful thing, but by being lucidly dreaming in the between state, bardo or between state, which great, when you have a greater level of mindfulness or self-awareness or lucid awareness, then you will be lucid through the death and rebirth process. You can. And this enables you actually to choose your rebirth location, which is their idea of reincarnation. That's really, in Buddhist lingo, we call that reincarnation. Ordinary impulse and instinct-driven rebirth on pure impulse with no control is called rebirth. So reincarnation is like a more conscious thing. But unconscious is driven to grab new life and therefore endangered of grabbing a form of life one will not like once one grabs it, has grabbed it, and it's grabbed you, which is what they worry about in cultures that have Buddhist biology, that feel that's sort of commonsensical. Buddhist biology is commonsensical. They do not feel that materialistic scientific materialism is commonsensical. It is a useful scientific approach to learn certain things, to manipulate certain things, but it's not really common sense, they feel. Because it's common sense, we know we have minds, because we are minds, and we know that. Even though we may not think that our minds are what we think they are when we really investigate them, but we still know that we have them. So dreaming. Dr. Nida, my dear friend, Dr. Nida Chinaktsang, who I consider the reincarnation of Yutok Yenden Gompo the Younger, who's also a Ngakpa, a kind of Tibetan Buddhist shaman, what they call Ngakpa, mantri, it means, and a great Nyingma Atiyoga or Dzogchen practitioner, and a great scholar of medicine and literature and things, really a wonderful guy. He teaches a wonderful thing called dream yoga, which he does here and there, and sometimes at our Menla Center in Phoenicia, New York. And he's really good about this. And he told me one story that I really like about someone who finally sort of lucidly dreamed, a person who was having a great deal of difficulty sleeping, a Tibetan person, because every time he would sleep, he would have this recurring nightmare. And in the nightmare, this sort of demonic, really harsh, like, you know, demonic cannibal kind of horror movie kind of character would be chasing him. And he would be frantically scrambling through jungles and forests and icy landscapes, different kinds of places, to get away from this demon. And then he would wake up, and so he didn't want to fall asleep because then he'd be getting chased again because it was recurring. And this went on for months and months, and he was getting haggard and unhealthy and sick. And finally he went to a doctor who was also a Ngakpa, Dr. Nida, like a guy like Dr. Nida. And doctor had tried giving him potions and medicines and things, but it didn't work. Dietary things for sleeping. Bone soup is considered a very good thing. Organic, clean yak bones, that is. The marrow, you know. But none of it worked. So he finally said to him, look, you just have to, in the dream, obviously this is some sort of a karma you have. You have to just turn around, stop running away, face that demon. And something might change. You have to somehow will yourself next time it happens, or eventually in one of those running away dreams, you turn and face that demon. So the guy said, okay, tried. He just kept having them waking up. And then finally in one dream, he managed to make it lucid by creating a strong intention at the time of falling asleep. Okay, I'm going to face that demon this time. He did. He whirled around. He stood right in front of the demon, stopped in front of him. He says, why are you chasing me? And the demon said, I don't know. It's your dream. Isn't that fun? I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh at my own jokes, but it's not really my jokes, Dr. Nida's. I think it's probably a well-known Tibetan story, probably, but I heard it from him. But isn't it wonderful? I don't know why I'm chasing you. It's your dream. That's really cool.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. Thank you. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to a very special edition of the Bob Thurman Podcast. What makes this special? Well, first, it's the topic. In the first half of this week's podcast, we got a taste of the Tibetan science and poetry of dream yoga, sleep yoga, and their bardo death process, and their understanding of it. As we heard, Professor Thurman shared his own history and experience with sleep yoga and the science that the Tibetans have that relate to sleep, dreaming, and how it all interconnects with the bardo. The mistitled Tibetan Book of the Dead, which Professor Thurman has a great translation of, which he discusses in the second half of the podcast. He ended the first half of the podcast sharing a great story that Dr. Nita likes to recount at his teachings. If you're inspired to learn more about Dr. Nita, definitely check out menla.us. He's got upcoming programs this fall with Professor Thurman that focus specifically on dream yoga. Now, in the second half of this week's podcast, Bob goes into further detail about dream yoga, sleep yoga, and the bardo process. So these texts on the second half of this podcast come with a slight trigger warning if you're afraid of death and don't want to hear about what might happen after you pass out of this mortal coil. Don't listen to the second half of this week's podcast. And better yet, don't even listen to our extra podcast bonus, which we're now including. We've got a new segment. It focuses on poetry, and it'll be hosted by renowned Chinese translator and poet Gary Gok. You might know Gary for his translations of various Chinese texts and poems, but you're probably more familiar with him for his book of anthology poetry called What Poem? We've got a working title of this segment called What Poem, but Gary and I and the team are still trying to figure out what might work best. So stay tuned. At the very end of this podcast, you'll get to hear a little 5-minute translation of a poem that Professor Thurman references in the podcast. Gary reads his translation of the poem and gives a short commentary. We hope you enjoy this new poetry segment that we'll be including in future episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast. It's a way we can honor one of Tibet House's founder, Allen Ginsberg. Little known fact, it was Allen who led me to Tibet House, and it turns out it was Professor Thurman who introduced Tibet House to Allen Ginsberg, who was brought on when they first began the effort to present and preserve Tibetan culture in New York City and in America. To learn more about this dynamic membership community, and to learn the benefits of becoming a member, please visit tibethouse.us. Your participation can help make a difference. And as always, the weekly interstitial music is provided by our dear friend, Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Bob, and stay tuned for Gary's poetry at the very end of this week's episode.
Now, here I have to recommend, I'm not plugging it. You can get it for a few bucks on Kindle, or you can copy it or download it from the Russians or something, probably. But my translation of Book of the Dead, so Tibetan Book of the Dead, so-called, wrongly called, but anyway, that's what it's known as. The study that I have of death in the beginning of that, I'm sorry to say it's the best treatment about that. And if you look at that, you'll see there are considered 8 stages of death and of sleeping. And that sleep and death and enlightenment are an aspect, you know, the ultimate reality, ultimate level of enlightenment are all lined up in Buddhist tantric abhidharma, let's call it, or tantric science, esoteric science, although nowadays it's not so esoteric. And there's these eight stages, and the eight stages are, the first four involve withdrawing your awareness from your coarse senses. And, you know, we spend a lot of time in our visual sense, and therefore in our visual sense consciousness. Like now I'm looking at the camera and the microphone and the room around it and so on, and the wonderful pine tree out the window. And so that's sort of part of my field. Then I'm hearing what I'm saying, as I have hearing aids and other sounds around. And then I'm smelling something, and then myself, and then some taste in my mouth from the last thing I ate, and the touch of the clothes on the skin and the butt on the seat, etc., you know. So touch, and the glasses resting on the bridge of my nose, and looped around my ears. So this is where I'm sort of thinking is me. And when I fall asleep, I let go of all of that. And in a way, we're so unself-controlled that we kind of have to be in a dark room, because if there's some light in the room, we'll be out in our visual field. We have to shut off and put earplugs on or make sure there's quiet in the room, because if there's noise, we'll be out there in our audio field. Then somehow we try to be clean. We take a shower before bed, or we have clean sheets or whatever, try to, if we're lucky, to live comfortably. And so that we don't have any much smells. We've brushed our teeth and so forth, so dinner is not still gurgling around in our gums. So we're not tasting too much. And then the touch thing, we're there, but it's the last touch we go in. It's like the face on the pillow, you know, the body on the soft mattress, hopefully, and a nice cover pulled up, tucked up. And then we shut down all of that. And then the last thing is our inner mental space, where we can reproduce in daydreaming. Images will flicker through our mind. Sentences, inner monologue, will go around thoughts. Verbal thoughts will course through our mind or memory of tunes and music or unpleasant sounds. Even will course through inward reproductions of those in our mind. And we try to withdraw the mind from being aware of those things. And then we slip into a kind of darkness. So those four stages, there's said to be four stages of that, just heuristically, where one is called earth going into water, which is where things feel less solid, when which things sort of feel like a mirage. You know, the inner senses of things being a mirage. That's how you withdraw from the sharp focus, visual field. And then they say water goes into fire, and that's where we see kind of fluttering, smoky feeling. We feel kind of a little bit of warmth, and it's like visually though there's a field of smoke. And then just wispy, could be misty or smoke. It doesn't have to be hot necessarily, although it gets warm. And then fire goes into wind. And wind, third one, and wind, then there's a thing of, not sparks, but they say like swarming fireflies, a vision of that, or moray patterns, or little drops hitting a still water surface where the ripples, the round ripples coming from the drops merge into each other, create interference patterns. And there's a inner perception like that, inner visual vision thing like that. And then finally, wind goes into consciousness, which is just pure consciousness without any sense element. And that the sign of that internally, they say, is like a candle flame, like it's just a still, not bright, but a sort of muted flame, like a yellowish, very still, not guttering or flickering, candle flame. And with those four, we normally just zonk out, you know, if we're really tired or we sort of go, but it said that those four stages are where you dissolve down to where you withdraw from your wakefulness, defined in terms of being invested in the awarenesses brought to you through the five senses, which they connect to the four primary elemental, but which really mean rigidity or solidity, fluidity, temperature or heat, warmth, and movement, motion, momentum, motility. They're not really like dirt or water. Even ordinary water has a little solidity to it, has a little motion to it, has a little warmth to it or coolness to it. So it isn't really, the earth, water, fire, wind are really abstractions, you could say, but they're useful. Then there's a phase where, which is divided into three of what's called the subtle mind, which we normally completely do not notice. But we will, they say, if you become a yogi or if we have a more conscious death process. And that's where we feel we're in a space, or that everything is a space. We feel we become space, like a sort of moonlit space, or like neon, kind of white neon, kind of luminosity, where we're luminance, I call it. And that's just, it's like a field, like we're in this it's a sense of vastness, but it isn't obtrusive vastness, it's just because it's a sort of mild white light. And then that white light, then our mind, not being used to being unbounded, kind of expands into it, seeking to encompass its vastness, seeking to find itself, almost, you could say, in a way, to sort of own or occupy this vast space that we sort of float in. And that creates heat, a simulation of heat, and it becomes like orangish red. And that's like a sunlit space. And then that becomes too bright and too intense, it's like explosive. And then that leads to the darkness of where we sort of fall into unconsciousness. And that's where you fall asleep. Or when in death you die, that's where you lose consciousness in death, they say. Or in meditation, that's where you've gotten to near to the deepest subtlety of life. And if you have a wrong theory of what the deepest level of reality is, you might think you're encountering nothingness there. It's a real danger of that, actually. Your theory will. It's not like there will be, but you're beyond words at that point, by the way. So it won't be like the word nothingness will come to you, because you don't have a sense of having a body even at that time, or word. But later you'll think, oh, that was the big nothing that I hit. That was the big big nothing, the big empty, the big void. But that's considered incorrect, because we do that every night. We become unconscious, and yet we don't disappear there. If it was nothing, there's no way you'd get out of it. And actually, of course, there's no way really you could get in it, because nothing is not a spatial thing. It's nothing. It's not a space. Nothing is nothing. A dark space is not nothing. Right? So then there's the deepest level. It's called clear light. And clear light is beyond words, unspeakable, but it's expressed in the form of various almost paradoxical or cognitively dissonant concepts. And one of them is the metaphor for it. It's like the empty space filled with the pre-dawn twilight. So it's a grayish, it's not dark and it's not bright. It's almost transparency, I like to say, like a dawn-like, grayish, transparent, translucent thing. Nothing differentiated, and there's no sense of darkness any longer. And then it's very, how do you perceive it? With what do you perceive it in a way, they say, since it's not nothing as an object. And in a way, it's not an object. It's because when you reach that, apparently, you become aware that that's what you are. So, but never mind, it gets too complicated. However, one of the nice things about it from the point of view of this kind of Buddhist inner science, enlightenment-oriented inner science, not rigidly materialistic inner science, not rigidly spiritualistic either, but this sort of really open-minded inner science, is that it's not a nothingness, a total absence of energy, this gray pre-dawn twilight. It's actually everything and it's infinite energy. And of course, when you say the word infinite energy, energy means something that does work, that moves, you know, that moves things, you know, that makes them happen, you know, it fulfills them, you know, it does things. You think of energy, you know, as a causing things. And this doesn't, because being infinite, everything is already done in a way. So it doesn't have any inner motive of doing anything, you could say. But it has, it's like a well and a source of, that can be infinitely drawn on. And this is very similar. I once talked to George Lucas, who is a dear friend, about the Force. And I said that, he said the Force was neither good nor bad, he insisted. And I said, then how come the good guys keep beating the bad guys? You know, the light side beats the dark side. The sight side, let's say, beats the dark side, the vision side, which is very Buddhist terminology, but he didn't know it from Buddhist terminology. He did it from his deep inner intuition, which is the great thing about Buddhism, is that it allows everybody, it agrees that everybody has inner enlightened intuition, but they unfortunately have shut themselves off from it all too often, you know, unfortunately. So his whole genius thing of the Force, that is the sort of the central energy of the Jedi, central energy of the great Star Wars empire that he created in the Star Wars world, is really the clear light of the void, is what we call it, what in Buddhist science it is called. Clear light, Prabhasvara in Sanskrit, Asal in Tibetan. And of course, clear light, that makes you think of light, but it's light that's clear. It's not light that's bright. I always was tempted to translate it as brilliance, clear light, because the word brilliant means a diamond, you know, in German, brilliant. But I never do. I resisted it because of the grayness of the twilight, the fact that brilliant means the opposite, it's obstructed and creates shadow by obstruction. So it's the opposite of darkness. So bright and dark, or light and dark, are opposite. Whereas clear light is a transparent light, a clear light. It's a light that doesn't shine on things because it's in everything. And I know that the language will not capture it either, because language, you have to have it light or dark. But that's the bed of infinite energy that is the base of the, you could say, it's not really a base because it's not underneath things, it is all the things. It's what, when you become enlightened, you understand. Anyway, my point is, the reason you feel rested, the reason you have to sleep, is that your mind, your ignorant mind, which means a mind that thinks you are some sort of entity apart from everything else. And in a way, you're in the very Buddha's great teaching and discovery was that as long as you think you are different from everything else, it's overwhelming. You cannot conquer it. You cannot cope with it. You can temporarily be in charge of your area, let's say, you know, and you can temporarily not be driven into some imbalance internally that makes you sick or whatever. So you're feeling all right and you're between what's within you and without you, and so temporarily. But overall, it's like endless, everything. And there's just infinite number of other people. You know, you will not emerge victorious in a struggle to hold your own, as we would say, in a realm of otherness. That's the first noble truth. And he would never have mentioned that noble truth, of course. It's the less true, in a way, let's say, than the third noble truth, which is, luckily, you are not different from everything else, because you and everything else are all this clear light, this infinite energy. You're all the Force. And when you're attuned to that, you're like a Jedi. You're not fighting anything because you are everything else in some level. You still can dance around with it, because one of its manifestations is it can make beings interact with it, make beings sort of responsible for different areas, and they can interact harmoniously with each other. Doesn't destroy anybody. You know, it's like being asleep and awake at the same time. But we can't, in our normal consciousness, we can't do that. So we have to leave our mind out of it, our ignorant, self-other, divisive, dualistic mind, what they call dualistic, making everything into two, of self and other, one of the foundational ones. We have to leave it out of it, and then the atoms, the subatomic particles, the inner strong forces within the atoms, the gravity, the cohesive force, the energy, infinite energy within, the vital energy, then draws from this infinite bed of energy, whatever it needs to remain in harmony with its infinite essence, let's say, its vast openness. And then it can restore your sense of being separate when you wake up. It makes you feel re-energized. You can face the day, okay? So in a way, it's like we're all the Borg. If you remember the Star Trek, you know, the Borg, they had to stand in a replenishing energy station. You know, they would go around these robotized human beings. They would stand in a thing and plug into it, and then it would, like, re-energize their mechanism, biological and mechanical mechanism, the Borg. So we're all Borg, in a way. But our Borg, luckily, we don't have to plug into it. We don't have to plug in because it's osmosis. It's the actual environment and the actual inner substance, too. So it's our merging with the infinite environment and the environment's gentle, replenishing, restorative. You could say loving if it was a person. Loving embrace. And mystics do that. They think of God as this vast, infinite, beautiful energy. And when they go into a trance, that's a kind of waking sleep, you know, meditative trance, and they feel one with this vast energy. And remember, when it's vast and infinite, the energy, it's not doing anything. So it isn't like a big rush. There might be a feeling of rush as you melt into it. But then in it, you're just it. And so and you also are calm, and there's nothing, you're peaceful, and there's nothing to proliferate, nothing to elaborate. As Buddha said, when he attained full enlightenment, nirvana, he said, profound, peaceful, non-proliferating, luminous, clear light, and uncreated, meaning it isn't made by a cause. I didn't create it. I didn't cause a state. It's just, that's what everything always has been. One acknowledges or becomes aware of where one really is, in other words, what one really is. That's what he's saying. So, and then he said, like an elixir of immortality is the reality I have found, he said, just discovered. And why immortality? Because the death state is the everything state. So it embraces all life. So then there is no death. There's only transitions between different forms of life. Which when one knows that, then life, then it's like being awake and asleep at the same time. Then you're replenishing while interacting and dishing out. So you're sort of like self-fueling, let's say, your cells. I don't know. He said it was inexpressible also, ultimately. He said those things because he felt them. But uncreated means, you know, I've always been that. We've always been that. All of us, when we achieve nirvana, what is called achieving nirvana in our dualistic language, which is assumed there's a state of not being in nirvana, achieving it is realizing we've always been in nirvana, in whatever state we've ever been in. That is why on the verge of that in the Buddha's life story, he remembers infinite previous lives. He's able to remember, we all have had the infinite previous lives. We've all been every kind of other thing, being, or thing even. But we don't remember because it was always a struggle. Who wants to remember such a huge struggle? It's like, I don't need horror movies because we've got there's enough horror on the planet. Personally, I don't really need them. Also, maybe I'm just scaredy cat too. I am actually scaredy cat. Anyway. So sleep is so important. So I always teach, and usually I do, you know, only at Menla, but I can teach. I can mention here that you know, you every night when you sleep, you really must work to correct your common sense view of reality that has been drummed into those of us educated in any modern society, not Western particularly, Eastern too, Northern, Southern, anywhere where we're educated. We are educated that material reality is ultimate reality, and there's no non-material thing except one, and thus nothingness. And so when that's your thing, then what you do by making a theory like that is you trap yourself in a notion that what this material reality is made up of is nothingness, and that ultimately you're nothing. And therefore, when you fall asleep and it goes dark, when you become unconscious, you've just entered nothingness. And you can be afraid of that, even. If you're having a nice time and you're happy and being awake, you'll be annoyed that you feel sleepy and take some anti-sleep speed or something, which is harmful to your long run, might be useful to study for an exam. But temporarily, but it's very harmful to your body. But you must think about it. If it was nothing, if nothing is the real thing, is the realest thing, because it means that the little bit of a life you have where you came out of nothing, had your moments of being awake, maybe 100 years, half of 100 years because you're asleep half the time, or maybe two-thirds or 100 if you only sleep 8 hours, average, then two-thirds of 100 years, 66 years maximum. And then we know the planet's been here for billions of years and will be here for billions more. The universe, stars and things. So that means that nothingness is much, even they will explode, you know. The nothingness, the dark space of nothingness is the much bigger thing, and so it's more ultimate, it's ultimate reality. And even we're taught that that's therefore safe, because you won't feel anything, you won't struggle, it's an escape. And therefore we might become heroin addicts if we're depressed, or we might commit suicide if we're depressed, because we think we're escaping into that nothing. So we must work to cure that. And you can't cure it just by saying, I'm just saying there's no nothing, although that helps. Obviously, there's no nothing, because that's what nothing means, that is not there. And your language cannot, not, no object, it's not an object of language. No thing, it just is a negation of something. But it's not a thing itself. We used to, all our words refer to something, so we're used to thinking that nothing refers to something. But obviously it doesn't, because it's nothing. So it's a non-referring negative term, that's all. Right? So, when you become unconscious, you don't enter or have a taste of the nothingness that you will enter at death. When you go unconscious, your mind of subject-object, self and other duality, dualism, making two out of everything, shuts down and puts itself in sleep mode. But where you are is in the vast bed of clear light, of emptiness. And emptiness is just another negative term, but it's a little more precise than nothingness. It's the state of the non-empty things, meaning they are all only related things. So your experience of a darkness is just a relative thing, actually. And in a way, the ultimate thing, which you are itself, is never an object to you. It's a subject, but it's not a subject as opposed to another object because it's everything else too. So in a way, it doesn't mean anything to say it's just a subject, to say it's just mind. It's beyond mind or matter. It's both matter and mind. It, you can say any of the one, two things about it. Okay, so that's where you go when you sleep. You merge. You should tell yourself, Luke, trust the force. Let yourself go into the force. And the fact that every night after deepest sleep and maybe some dreams in between, you arise again means that force is good. It doesn't swallow you up, doesn't destroy you. That means also death will not destroy you. But then how you arise, well, that has to do with how you went to sleep, what you were doing relationally, how you understand your being unconscious, and then how you understand maybe your dreams that you have, which teach you things too, if you can remember them. So then you get into this idea of being more lucid about your dreaming. And that's where Dr. Nida teaches and we teach and we work on. But there are a lot of people who do, and they don't have to be Buddhists. You know, you keep a journal of any dreams you do remember. You write them down right away in the morning, if possible. Keep a journal by your bedside and a pen, pencil. You tell yourself when you're falling asleep, in case I dream, I want to be aware that I'm in the dream when I'm dreaming. And then first, maybe that won't make any difference, and sometimes you'll forget to do it, but you keep trying to come back to that. Make it a practice. Keep the crap off your sleep table. And keep that notebook right there, staring you in the face, dream book. Write it down. You will definitely be able to lucidly dream. Then you have a lot of things you will learn. And it gets very, very deep. And I will just finish this and close with a statement of the great Zhuangzi, who was, he was a Buddhist in the sense of he sought enlightenment, and he was probably enlightened. He's considered a Taoist, philosophical Taoist, in Chinese thing, but religion, but eventually philosophy, religion, but it's just the same as Buddhism, really, almost. And he said, last night I dreamed I was a butterfly. It was so vivid, he said. Today I don't even know for sure if I'm a butterfly dreaming I'm Zhuangzi, or I'm Zhuangzi remembering I dreamed I was a butterfly. And that's when, by learning to lucidly dream, he's become more lucidly awake. And when you're more lucidly awake, you sort of understand, you know, there was famous Spanish play by Calderón de la Barca, the Shakespeare of Spain, called Life is But a Dream. La vida es sueño. Life is a dream. La vida es sueño. Really great. Great, great play. I have a friend who has a movie maker who's one of their longly beloved projects that they will make, set in a modern period about that, in Spanish. Wonderful thing. I hope she produces it. La vida es sueño. Okay? So this podcast is part of the dream. So you enjoy it. See you again. Okay?
This segment of the Bob Thurman podcast is Gary Gawk reading from the Taoist philosopher Chuangzi, who lived 2,000 years ago. He wrote, "Once upon a time, I, Chuangzi, dreamed I was a butterfly, freely fluttering around, enjoying the cool breeze and the fragrant trees, doing whatever I pleased, and knowing nothing of Chuangzi. Suddenly, I awoke. There I was, Chuangzi in the flesh. Now, I don't know whether I had been dreaming I was a butterfly, or if a butterfly is now dreaming it is me. Then there are two lines added, which I suspect might be written by the person who compiled Chuang Tzu, the way morals were added to Aesop's fables. It goes like this. Surely we can distinguish between a human being and a butterfly. This is a case of the transformation of things. Well, anywho, Chuang Tzu leaves us in a kind of bardo, doesn't he? Master Chuang makes a discrimination between a butterfly and a human being. Yet if we listen deeply, we can hear him saying he was completely aware of being a butterfly, kind of like in a lucid dream, just as he was aware of being completely a human being in the flesh. And in that awareness of being and becoming is the seed of a bigger awakening. If Chuang Tzu doesn't quite take us there, he leaves us at the gate of a bigger awakening, the view of no views, call it nirvana, without demarcation lines discriminating between butterfly and human, dreaming and waking, this or that, self or other. These humble words, or your own enlightened nature. Chuang Tzu reminds us, awakening can happen instantaneously, like that, like right now. Maybe he's asking, whose dream are you? And who are you? Who are you, really? What's your inmost dream? And what if you awoke to it instantaneously? Argentinian author Jorge Luis Borges offers us caterpillars these encouraging words of commentary. A butterfly has something delicate and evanescent about it. If we are dreams, the true way to suggest this is with a butterfly and not a tiger. If Chuang Tzu had a dream that he was a typewriter, it would be no good at all. Or a whale, that would do him no good either. I think he has chosen just the right word for what he is trying to say. I'm Gary Gawk, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast. It's published by Tibet House US under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portals.